In case she shall be dead before me, it is my wish that it be burned, with everything it contains, without opening or altering anything. In order that no one may plead ignorance, I swear by the God that I adore, and by all that is held most sacred, that I assert nothing but the truth, and if my intentions, just and reasonable as they are, be thwarted in this point by any persons, I charge their consciences with it, both in this world and that which is to come, in order that I may unload mine. I protest that this is my last will. Done at Paris, May 25th, 1672. Signed, Sainte Croix. This earnest solicitation, instead of ensuring respect, as was intended, excited curiosity. The box was opened, and found it to contain some papers and several vials and powders. The latter were handed to a chemist for analysis, and the documents were retained by the police and opened. Among them was found a promissory note of the Marchioness de Brinvilliers for 30,000 francs to the Order of Sainte Croix. The other papers were of greater importance, as they implicated both her and her servant, La Chaussée, in the recent murders. As soon as she was informed of the death of Sainte Croix, she made an attempt to gain possession of his papers and the box. But being refused, she saw that there was no time to be lost, and immediately quitted. Next morning the police were on her trail, but she succeeded in escaping to England. La Chaussée was not so fortunate. Altogether ignorant of the fatal mischance which had brought his villainies to life, he did not dream of danger. He was arrested and brought to trial. Being put to the torture, he confessed that he had administered poison to the Monsieur d'Aubray, and that he had received 100 pistoles and the promise of an annuity for life from Sainte Croix and Madame de Brinvilliers for the job. He was condemned to be broken alive on the wheel, and the Marchioness was by default sentenced to be beheaded. He was executed accordingly in March 1673 on the Place de Grève in Paris. Le Brinvilliers appears to have resided for nearly 3 years in England. Early in 1676, thinking that the rigor of pursuit was over, and that she might venture to return to the continent, she proceeded secretly to Liège. Notwithstanding her care, the French authorities were soon apprised of her return, and arrangements were promptly made with the municipality of that city to permit the agents of the French police to arrest her within the limits of their jurisdiction. Desgrais, an officer of the Maréchaussée, accordingly left Paris for that purpose. On his arrival in Liège, he found that she had sought shelter within the walls of a convent. Here the arm of the law, long as it is said to be, could not reach her, but Desgrais was not a man to be baffled, and he resorted to stratagem to accomplish what force could not. Having disguised himself as a priest, he sought admission to the convent and obtained an interview with La Brinvilliers. He said that, being a Frenchman and passing through Liège, he could not leave that city without paying a visit to a lady whose beauty and misfortunes were so celebrated. Her vanity was flattered by the compliment. Desgrais saw, to use a vulgar but forcible expression, that he had got on the blind side of her, and he adroitly continued to pour out the language of love and admiration till the deluded marchioness was thrown completely off her guard. She agreed, without much solicitation, to meet him outside the walls of the convent, where their amorous intrigue might be carried on more conveniently than within. Faithful to her appointment with her supposed new lover, she came and found herself not in the embrace of a gallant, but in the custody of a policeman. Her trial was not long delayed. The proofs against her were abundant. The dying declaration of La Chaussée would have been alone enough to convict her. But besides that, there were the mysterious document attached to the box of Sainte Croix, her flight from France, and, stronger and more damning proof than all, a paper in her own handwriting found among the effects of Sainte Croix, in which she detailed to him the misdeeds of her life, and spoke of the murder of her father and brothers in terms that left no doubt of her guilt. During the trial, all Paris was in commotion. La Brinvilliers was the only subject of conversation. All the details of her crimes were published and greedily devoured, and the idea of secret poisoning first put into the heads of hundreds, who afterwards became guilty of it. On the 16th of July, 1676, the Superior Criminal Court of Paris pronounced a verdict of guilty against her, for the murder of her father and brothers and the attempt upon the life of her sister. She was condemned to be drawn on a hurdle with her feet bare, a rope about her neck, and a burning torch in her hand, to the great entrance of the Cathedral of Notre Dame, where she was to make the amende honorable in sight of all the people, to be taken from thence to the Place de Grève, and there to be beheaded. Her body was afterwards to be burned, and her ashes scattered to the winds. After her sentence, she made a full confession of her guilt. She seems to have looked upon death without fear, but it was recklessness, not courage, that supported her. Madame de Sévigné says that when on the hurdle, on her way to the scaffold, she entreated her confessor to exert his influence with the executioner to place himself next to her, that his body might hide from her view that scoundrel des Grès who had entrapped her. She also asked the ladies, who had been drawn to their windows to witness the procession, what they were looking at, adding, "A pretty sight you have come to see, truly." She laughed when on the scaffold, dying as she had lived, impenitent and heartless. On the morrow the populace came in crowds to collect her ashes to preserve them as relics. She was regarded as a martyred saint, and her ashes were supposed to be endowed by divine grace with the power of curing all diseases. Popular folly has often canonized persons whose pretensions to sanctity were extremely equivocal, but the disgusting folly of the multitude in this instance has never been surpassed. Before her death, proceedings were instituted against Monsieur de Penautier, treasurer of the province of Languedoc, and receiver general for the clergy, who was accused by a lady named Saint-Laurent of having poisoned her husband, the late receiver general, in order to obtain his appointment. The circumstances of this case were never divulged, and the greatest influence was exerted to prevent it from going to trial. He was known to have been intimate with Sainte-Croix and Madame de Brinvilliers, and was thought to have procured his poisons from them. The latter, however, refused to say anything which might implicate him. The inquiry was eventually stifled after Penautier had been several months in the Bastille. The Cardinal de Bonzy was accused by the gossips of the day of being an accomplice of Penautier. The cardinal's estates were burdened with the payment of several heavy annuities, but about the time that poisoning became so fashionable, all the annuitants died off, one after the other. The cardinal, in talking of these annuitants, afterwards used to say, "Thanks to my star, I have outlived them all." A wit, seeing him and Penautier riding in the same carriage, cried out in allusion to this expression, "There go the Cardinal de Bonzy and his star." It was now that the mania for poisoning began to take hold of the popular mind. From this time until the year 1682, the prisons of France teemed with persons accused of this crime, and it is very singular what other offenses decreased in a similar proportion. We have already seen the extent to which it was carried in Italy. It was, if possible, surpassed in France. The diabolical ease with which these murders could be effected by means of these scentless and tasteless poisons enticed the evil-minded. Jealousy, revenge, avarice, even petty spite alike resorted to them. Those who would have been deterred by fear of detection from using the pistol or the dagger, or even strong doses of poison which kill at once, employed slow poisons without dread. The corrupt government of the day, although it could wink at the atrocities of a wealthy and influential courtier like Penautier, was scandalized to see the crime spreading among the people. Disgrace was, in fact, entailed in the eyes of Europe upon the name of Frenchman. Louis XIV, to put a stop to the evil, instituted what was called the Chambre Ardente, or Burning Chamber, with extensive powers for the trial and punishment of the prisoners. Two women especially made themselves notorious at this time and were instrumental to the deaths of hundreds of individuals. They both resided in Paris and were named La Voisin and La Vigoureux. Like Spara and Tophania, of whom they were imitators, they chiefly sold their poisons to women who wanted to get rid of their husbands, and in some few instances to husbands who wanted to get rid of their wives. Their ostensible occupation was that of midwives. They also pretended to be fortune-tellers and were visited by persons of every class of society. The rich and poor thronged alike to their mansarde to learn the secrets of the future. Their prophecies were principally of death. They foretold to women the approaching dissolution of husbands, and to needy heirs the end of rich relatives, who had made them, as Byron expresses it, wait too long already. They generally took care to be instrumental in fulfilling their own predictions. They used to tell their wretched employers that some sign of the approaching death would take place in the house, such as the breaking of glass or china, and they paid servants considerable fees to cause a breakage, as if by accident, exactly at the appointed time. Their occupation as midwives made them acquainted with the secrets of many families, which they afterwards turned to dreadful account. It is not known how long they had carried on this awful trade before they were discovered. Detection finally overtook them at the close of the year 1679. They were both tried, found guilty, and burned alive on the Place de Grève on the 22nd of February 1680, after their hands had been bored through with a red-hot iron and then cut off. Their numerous accomplices in Paris and in the provinces were also discovered and brought to trial. According to some authors, 30, and to others 50 of them, chiefly women, were hanged in the principal cities. Lavoisin kept a list of the visitors who came to her house to purchase poisons. This paper was seized by the police on her arrest and examined by the tribunals. Among the names were found those of the Marshal de Luxembourg, the Countess de Soissons, and the Duchess de Bouillon. The marshal seems only to have been guilty of a piece of discreditable folly in visiting a woman of this description, but the popular voice at the time imputed to him something more than folly. The author of the Memoirs of the Affairs of Europe since the Peace of Utrecht says, "The miserable gang who dealt in poison and prophecy alleged that he had sold himself to the devil, and that a young girl of the name of Dupin had been poisoned by his means. Among other stories, they said he had made a contract with the devil in order to marry his son to the daughter of the Marquis of Louvois. To this atrocious and absurd accusation, the marshal, who had surrendered himself at the Bastille on the first accusation against him, replied with a mingled sentiment of pride and innocence, 'When Mathieu de Montmorency, my ancestor, married the widow of Louis le Gros, he did not have recourse to the devil but to the States General, in order to obtain for the minor king the support of the House of Montmorency.' This brave man was imprisoned in a cell 6 feet and a half long, and his trial, which was interrupted for several weeks, lasted altogether 14 months. No judgment was pronounced upon him. The Countess of Soissons fled to Brussels rather than undergo the risk of a trial, and was never able to clear herself from the stigma that attached to her of having made an attempt to poison the Queen of Spain by doses of succession powder. The Duchess of Bouillon was arrested and tried by the Chambre Ardente. It would appear, however, that she had nothing to do with the slow poisons, but had merely endeavored to pry into the secrets of futurity and gratify her curiosity with a sight of the devil. One of the presidents of the Chambre, Le Rigny, an ugly little old man, very seriously asked her whether she had really seen the devil. To which the lady replied, looking him full in the face, "Oh, yes, I see him now. He is in the form of a little ugly old man, exceedingly ill-natured, and is dressed in the robes of a counselor of state." Monsieur Larigny prudently refrained from asking any more questions of a lady with so sharp and ready a tongue. The Duchess was imprisoned for several months in the Bastille, and nothing being proved against her, she was released at the intercession of her powerful friends. The severe punishment of criminals of this note might have helped to abate the fever of imitation among the vulgar. Their comparative impunity had a contrary tendency. The escape of Penautier and the wealthy Cardinal de Bonzy, his employer, had the most pernicious effect. For 2 years longer, the crime continued to rage and was not finally suppressed till the stake had blazed or the noose dangled for upwards of 100 individuals. Slow poisoning is a crime which has unhappily been revived in England within the last few years, and which has been carried to an extent sufficient to cast a stain upon the national character. The poisoners have been principally women of the lowest classes, and their victims have been their husbands or their children. The motive for the crime has in most instances been the basest that can be imagined. The desire to obtain from burial clubs to which they subscribed the premium or burial money, a recent enactment restricting the sale of arsenic and other poisons, will, it is to be hoped, check if it do not extirpate this abominable crime. 1851. Haunted Houses. Here's a knocking indeed. Knock, knock, knock. Who's there in the name of Beelzebub? Who's there in the devil's name? Knock, knock, knock. Never at quiet? Macbeth. Who has not either seen or heard of some house, shut up and uninhabitable, fallen into decay and looking dusty and dreary, from which at midnight strange sounds have been heard to issue, aerial knockings, the rattling of chains, and the groaning of perturbed spirits? A house that people have thought it unsafe to pass after dark, and which has remained for years without a tenant, and which no tenant would occupy, even were he paid to do so. There are hundreds of such houses in England at the present day, hundreds in France, Germany, and almost every country of Europe, which are marked with the mark of fear, places for the timid to avoid, and the pious to bless themselves at, and ask protection from as they pass, the abodes of ghosts and evil spirits. There are many such houses in London, and if any vain boaster of the march of intellect would but take the trouble to find them out and count them, he would be convinced that intellect must yet make some enormous strides before such old superstitions can be eradicated. The idea that such houses exist is a remnant of the witch creed, which merits separate notice from its comparative harmlessness and from its being not so much a madness as a folly of the people. Unlike other notions that sprang from the belief in witchcraft and which we have already dwelt upon at sufficient length, it has sent no wretches to the stake or the gibbet, and but a few to the pillory only. Many houses have been condemned as haunted and avoided by the weak and credulous from circumstances the most trifling in themselves, and which only wanted a vigorous mind to clear up at once and dissipate all alarm. A house in Aix-la-Chapelle, a large, desolate-looking building, remained uninhabited for 5 years on account of the mysterious knockings that there were heard within it at all hours of the day and night. Nobody could account for the noises, and the fear became at last so excessive that the persons who inhabited the houses on either side relinquished their tenancy, and went to reside in other quarters of the town, where there was less chance of interruption from evil spirits. From being so long without an inhabitant, the house at last grew so ruinous, so dingy, and so miserable in its outward appearance, and so like the place that ghosts might be supposed to haunt, that few persons cared to go past it after sunset. The knocking that was heard in one of the upper rooms was not very loud, but it was very regular. The gossips of the neighborhood asserted that they often heard groans from the cellars and saw lights moved about from one window to another immediately after the midnight bell had tolled. Spectres in white habiliments were reported to have jibed and chattered from the windows. But all these stories could bear no investigation. The knocking, however, was a fact which no one could dispute, and several ineffectual attempts were made by the proprietor to discover the cause. The rooms were sprinkled with holy water. The evil spirits were commanded in due form by a priest to depart thence to the Red Sea. But the knockings still continued, in spite of all that could be done in that way. Accident at last discovered the cause and restored tranquility to the neighborhood. The proprietor, who suffered not only in his mind but in his pocket, had sold the building at a ruinously small price to get rid of all future annoyance. The new proprietor was standing in a room on the first floor when he heard the door driven to at the bottom with a considerable noise, and then fly open immediately, about 2 inches and no more. He stood still a minute and watched, and the same thing occurred a second and a third time. He examined the door attentively, and all the mystery was unraveled. The latch of the door was broken so that it could not be fastened, and it swung chiefly upon the bottom hinge. Immediately opposite was a window in which one pane of glass was broken, and when the wind was in a certain quarter, the draft of air was so strong that it blew the door to with some violence. There being no latch, it swung open again, and when there was a fresh gust, was again blown to. The new proprietor lost no time in sending for a glazier, and the mysterious noises ceased forever. The house was replastered and repainted, and once more regained its lost good name. It was not before 2 or 3 years, however, that it was thoroughly established in popular favor, and many persons, even then, would always avoid passing it if they could reach their destination by any other street. A similar story is narrated by Sir Walter Scott in his Letters on Demonology and Witchcraft, the hero of which was a gentleman of birth and distinction, well known in the political world. Shortly after he succeeded to his title and estates, there was a rumor among the servants concerning a strange noise that used to be heard at night in the family mansion, and the cause of which no one could ascertain. The gentleman resolved to discover it himself, and to watch for that purpose with a domestic who had grown old in the family, and who, like the rest, had whispered strange things about the knocking having begun immediately upon the death of his old master. These two watched until the noise was heard, and at last traced it to a small storeroom used as a place for keeping provisions of various kinds for the family, and of which the old butler had the key. They entered this place and remained for some time without hearing the noises which they had traced thither. At length the sound was heard, but much lower than it seemed to be while they were farther off, and their imaginations were more excited. They then discovered the cause without difficulty. A rat, caught in an old-fashioned trap, had occasioned the noise by its efforts to escape, in which it was able to raise the trap-door of its prison to a certain height, but was then obliged to drop it. The noise of the fall resounding through the house had occasioned the mysterious rumors, which, but for the investigation of the proprietor, would, in all probability, have acquired so bad a name for the dwelling that no servants would have inhabited it. The circumstance was told to Sir Walter Scott by the gentleman to whom it happened. But in general, houses that have acquired this character have been more indebted for it to the roguery of living men than to accidents like these. 6 monks played off a clever trick of the kind upon that worthy king, Louis, whose piety has procured him in the annals of his own country the designation of the saint. Having heard his confessor speak in terms of warm eulogy of the goodness and learning of the monks of the Order of St. Bruno, he expressed his wish to establish a community of them near Paris. Bernard de la Tour, the superior, sent 6 of the brethren, and the king gave them a handsome house to live in the village of Chantilly. It so happened that from their windows they had a very fine view of the ancient palace of Vauvert, which had been built for a royal residence by King Robert, but deserted for many years. The worthy monks thought the palace would just suit them, but their modesty was so excessive that they were ashamed to ask the king for a grant of it in due form. This difficulty was not to be overcome, and the monks set their ingenuity to work to discover another plan. The palace of Vauvert had never labored under any imputation upon its character until they became its neighbors. But somehow or other, it almost immediately afterwards began to acquire a bad name. Frightful shrieks were heard to proceed from it at night. Blue, red, and green lights were suddenly seen to glimmer from the windows, and as suddenly to disappear. The clanking of chains was heard, and the howling as of persons in great pain. These disturbances continued for several months, to the great terror of all the country round, and even of the pious King Louis, to whom, at Paris, all the rumors were regularly carried with whole heaps of additions that accumulated on the way. At last a great specter, clothed all in pea-green, with a long white beard and a serpent's tail, took his station regularly at midnight in the principal window of the palace, and howled fearfully and shook his fists at the passengers. The 6 monks at Chantilly, to whom all these things were duly narrated, were exceedingly wrath that the devil should play such antics right opposite their dwelling, and hinted to the commissioners sent down by St. Louis to investigate the matter, that if they were allowed to inhabit the palace, they would very soon make a clearance of the evil spirits. The king was quite charmed with their piety, and expressed to them how grateful he felt for their disinterestedness. A deed was forthwith drawn up, the royal sign manual was affixed to it, and the palace of Vauvert became the property of the monks of St. Bruno. The deed is dated 1259. The disturbances ceased immediately, the lights disappeared, and the green ghost, so said the monks, was laid at rest forever under the waves of the Red Sea. In the year 1580, one Gilles Blacre had taken the lease of a house in the suburbs of Tours, but repenting him of his bargain with the landlord, Peter Piquet, he endeavored to prevail upon him to cancel the agreement. Peter, however, was satisfied with his tenant and his terms and would listen to no compromise. Very shortly afterwards, the rumor was spread all over Tours that the house of Gilles Blacre was haunted. Gilles himself asserted that he verily believed his house to be the general rendezvous of all the witches and evil spirits of France. The noise they made was awful and quite prevented him from sleeping. They knocked against the wall, howled in the chimneys, broke his window glass, scattered his pots and pans all over his kitchen, and set his chairs and tables a-dancing the whole night through. Crowds of persons assembled round the house to hear the mysterious noises, and the bricks were observed to detach themselves from the wall and fall into the streets upon the heads of those who had not said their paternoster before coming out in the morning. These things having continued for some time, Gilles Blacre made his complaint to the civil court of Tours, and Peter Piquet was summoned to show cause why the lease should not be annulled. Poor Peter could make no defense, and the court unanimously agreed that no lease could hold good under such circumstances, and annulled it accordingly, condemning the unlucky owner to all the expenses of the suit. Peter appealed to the Parliament of Paris, and after a long examination, the Parliament confirmed the lease. Not, said the judge, because it has not been fully and satisfactorily proved that the house is troubled by evil spirits, but that there was an informality in the proceedings before the civil court of Tours that rendered its decision null and of no effect. A similar cause was tried before the Parliament of Bordeaux in the year 1595, relative to a house in that city which was sorely troubled by evil spirits. The Parliament appointed certain ecclesiastics to examine and report to them, and on their report in the affirmative that the house was haunted, the lease was annulled, and the tenant absolved from all payment of rent and taxes. One of the best stories of a haunted house is that of the Royal Palace of Woodstock in the year 1649, when the commissioners sent from London by the Long Parliament to take possession of it and efface all the emblems of royalty about it, were fairly driven out by their fear of the devil and the annoyances they suffered from a roguish cavalier who played the imp to admiration. The commissioners, dreading at that time no devil, arrived at Woodstock on the 13th of October, 1649. They took up their lodgings in the late king's apartments, turned the beautiful bedrooms and withdrawing rooms into kitchens and sculleries, the council hall into a brewhouse, and made the dining room a place to keep firewood in. They pulled down all the insignia of royal state and treated with the utmost indignity everything that recalled to their memory the name or the majesty of Charles Stuart. One Giles Sharp accompanied them in the capacity of clerk and seconded their efforts, apparently with the greatest zeal. He aided them to uproot a noble old tree merely because it was called the King's Oak, and tossed the fragments into the dining room to make cheerful fires for the commissioners. During the first 2 days, they heard some strange noises about the house, but they paid no great attention to them. On the third, however, they began to suspect they had got into bad company, for they heard, as they thought, a supernatural dog under their bed, which gnawed their bedclothes. On the next day, the chairs and tables began to dance, apparently of their own accord. On the fifth day, something came into the bedchamber and walked up and down, and fetching the warming pan out of the withdrawing room, made so much noise with it that they thought five church bells were ringing in their ears. On the sixth day, the plates and dishes were thrown up and down the dining room. On the seventh, they penetrated into the bedroom in company with several logs of wood and usurped the soft pillows intended for the commissioners. On the eighth and ninth nights, there was a cessation of hostilities, but on the tenth, the bricks in the chimneys became locomotive and rattled and danced about the floors and round the heads of the commissioners all the night long. On the 11th, the demon ran away with their breeches, and on the 12th filled their beds so full of pewter platters that they could not get into them. On the 13th night, the glass became unaccountably seized with a fit of cracking, and fell into shivers in all parts of the house. On the 14th, there was a noise as if 40 pieces of artillery had been fired off, and a shower of pebble stones, which so alarmed the commissioners that, struck with great horror, they cried out to one another for help. They first of all tried the efficacy of prayers to drive away the evil spirits, but these proving unavailing, they began seriously to reflect whether it would not be much better to leave the place altogether to the devils that inhabited it. They ultimately resolved, however, to try it a little longer, and having craved forgiveness of all their sins, betook themselves to bed. That night they slept in tolerable comfort, but it was merely a trick of their tormentor to lull them into false security. When, on the succeeding night, they heard no noises, they began to flatter themselves that the devil was driven out, and prepared accordingly to take up their quarters for the whole winter in the palace. These symptoms on their part became the signal for renewed uproar among the fiends. On the 1st of November, they heard something walking with a slow and solemn pace up and down the withdrawing room, and immediately afterwards a shower of stones, bricks, mortar, and broken glass pelted about their ears. On the 2nd, the steps were again heard in the withdrawing room, sounding to their fancy very much like the treading of an enormous bear, which continued for about a quarter of an hour. This noise having ceased, a large warming pan was thrown violently upon the table, followed by a number of stones and the jawbone of a horse. Some of the boldest walked valiantly into the withdrawing room, armed with swords and pistols, but could discover nothing. They were afraid that night to go to sleep, and sat up, making fires in every room and burning candles and lamps in great abundance, thinking that, as the fiends loved darkness, they would not disturb a company surrounded with so much light. They were deceived, however. Buckets of water came down the chimneys and extinguished the fires, and the candles were blown out, they knew not how. Some of the servants who had betaken themselves to bed were drenched with putrid ditch water as they lay, and arose in great fright, muttering incoherent prayers and exposing to the wondering eyes of the commissioners their linen all dripping with green moisture and their knuckles red with the blows they had at the same time received from some invisible tormentors. While they were still speaking, there was a noise like the loudest thunder or the firing of a whole park of artillery, upon which they all fell down upon their knees and implored the protection of the Almighty. One of the commissioners then arose, the others still kneeling, and asked in a courageous voice, and in the name of God, who was there, and what they had done that they should be troubled in that manner. No answer was returned, and the noises ceased for a while. At length, however, as the commissioners said, the devil came again and brought with it 7 devils worse than itself. Being again in darkness, they lighted a candle and placed it in the doorway, that it might throw a light upon the 2 chambers at once. But it was suddenly blown out, and one commissioner said that he had seen the similitude of a horse's hoof striking the candle and candlestick into the middle of the chamber, and afterwards making 3 scrapes on the snuff to put it out. Upon this, the same person was so bold as to draw his sword, but he asserted positively that he had hardly withdrawn it from the scabbard, before an invisible hand seized hold of it and tugged with him for it, and prevailing, struck him so violent a blow with the pommel that he was quite stunned. Then the noises began again, upon which, with one accord, they all retired into the presence chamber, where they passed the night praying and singing psalms. They were by this time convinced that it was useless to struggle any longer with the powers of evil that seemed determined to make Woodstock their own. These things happened on the Saturday night, and being repeated on the Sunday, they determined to leave the place immediately and return to London. By Tuesday morning early, all their preparations were completed, and shaking the dust off their feet and devoting Woodstock and all its inhabitants to the infernal gods, they finally took their departure. Many years elapsed before the true cause of these disturbances was discovered. It was ascertained at the Restoration that the whole was the work of Giles Sharp, the trusty clerk of the commissioners. This man, whose real name was Joseph Collins, was a concealed royalist, and had passed his early life within the bowers of Woodstock, so that he knew every hole and corner of the place, and the numerous trapdoors and secret passages that abounded in the building. the commissioners, never suspecting the true state of his opinions, but believing him to be revolutionary to the backbone, placed the utmost reliance upon him, a confidence which he abused in the manner above detailed, to his own great amusement and that of the few cavaliers whom he let into the secret. Quite as extraordinary and as cleverly managed was the trick played off at Tedworth in 1661 at the house of Mr. Mompesson, and which is so circumstantially narrated by the Reverend Joseph Glanville under the title of The Demon of Tedworth, and appended, among other proofs of witchcraft, to his noted work called Sadducismus Triumphatus. About the middle of April, in the year above mentioned, Mr. Mompesson, having returned to his house at Tedworth from a journey he had taken to London, was informed by his wife that during his absence they had been troubled with the most extraordinary noises. 3 nights afterwards he heard the noise himself, and it appeared to him to be that of a great knocking at his doors and on the outside of his walls. He immediately arose, dressed himself, took down a pair of pistols, and walked valiantly forth to discover the disturber, under the impression that it must be a robber. But as he went, the noise seemed to travel before or behind him, and when he arrived at the door from which he thought it proceeded, he saw nothing, but still heard a strange hollow sound. He puzzled his brains for a long time and searched every corner of the house, but discovering nothing, he went to bed again. He was no sooner snug under the clothes than the noise began again more furiously than ever, sounding very much like a thumping and drumming on the top of his house, and then, by degrees, going off into the air. These things continued for several nights, when it came to the recollection of Mr. Mompesson that some time before he had given orders for the arrest and imprisonment of a wandering drummer who went about the country with a large drum, disturbing quiet people and soliciting alms, and that he had detained the man's drum, and that probably the drummer was a wizard, and he had sent evil spirits to haunt his house to be revenged of him. He became strengthened in his opinion every day, especially when the noises assumed, to his fancy, a resemblance to the beating of a drum, like that at the breaking up of a guard. Mrs. Mompesson being brought to bed, the devil or the drummer very kindly and considerately refrained from making the usual riot, but as soon as she recovered strength, began again in a ruder manner than before, following and vexing the young children, and beating their bedsteads with so much violence that everyone expected they would fall in pieces. For an hour together, as the worthy Mr. Mompesson repeated to his wondering neighbors, this infernal drummer would beat round heads and cuckolds, the tattoo, and several other points of war as cleverly as any soldier. When this had lasted long enough, he changed his tactics and scratched with his iron talons under the children's bed. On the 5th of November, says the Reverend Joseph Glanville, it made a mighty noise, and a servant observing 2 boards in the children's room seeming to move, he bid it give him one of them, upon which the board came, nothing moving it that he saw, within a yard of him. The man added, "Nay, let me have it in my hand," upon which the spirit, devil, or drummer pushed it towards him so close that he might touch it. This, continues Glanville, was in the daytime and was seen by a whole room full of people. That morning it left a sulphurous smell behind it, which was very offensive. At night the minister, one Mr. Cragg, and several of the neighbors came to the house on a visit. Mr. Cragg went to prayers with them, kneeling at the children's bedside, where it then became very troublesome and loud. During prayer time, the spirit withdrew into the cockloft, but returned as soon as prayers were done. And then, in sight of the company, the chairs walked about the room of themselves. The children's shoes were hurled over their heads, and every loose thing moved about the chamber. At the same time, a bedstaff was thrown at the minister, which hit him on the leg, but so favorably that a lock of wool could not have fallen more softly. On another occasion, the blacksmith of the village, a fellow who cared neither for ghost nor devil, slept with John the footman, that he also might hear the disturbances and be cured of his incredulity, when there came a noise in the room as if one had been shoeing a horse, and somewhat came, as it were, with a pair of pincers, snipping and snapping at the poor blacksmith's nose the greater part of the night. Next day it came panting like a dog out of breath, upon which some woman present took a bedstaff to knock at it, which was caught suddenly out of her hand and thrown away, and the company coming up, the room was presently filled with a bloomy, noisome smell, and was very hot, though without fire, in a very sharp and severe winter. It continued in the bed, panting and scratching for an hour and a half, and then went into the next room, where it knocked a little and seemed to rattle a chain. The rumor of these wonderful occurrences soon spread all over the country, and people from far and near flocked to the haunted house of Tedworth, to believe or doubt as their natures led them, but all filled with intense curiosity. It appears, too, that the fame of these events reached the royal ear, and that some gentlemen were sent by the king to investigate the circumstances and draw up a report of what they saw or heard. Whether the royal commissioners were more sensible men than the neighbors of Mr. Mompesson and required more clear and positive evidence than they, or whether the powers with which they were armed to punish any body who might be found carrying on this deception frightened the evildoers, is not certain. But Glanville himself reluctantly confesses that all the time they were in the house the noises ceased, and nothing was heard or seen. However, says he, as to the quiet of the house when the courtiers were there, the intermission may have been accidental, or perhaps the demon was not willing to give so public a testimony of those transactions, which might possibly convince those who he had rather should continue in unbelief of his existence. As soon as the royal commissioners took their departure, the infernal drummer recommenced his antics, and hundreds of persons were daily present to hear and wonder. Mr. Mompesson's servant was so fortunate as not only to hear but to see this pertinacious demon, for it came and stood at the foot of his bed. The exact shape and proportion of it he could not discover, but he saw a great body with two red and glaring eyes, which for some time were fixed steadily on him and at length disappeared. Innumerable were the antics it played. Once it purred like a cat, beat the children's legs black and blue, put a long spike into Mr. Mompesson's bed and a knife into his mother's, filled the porringers with ashes, hid a Bible under the grate, and turned the money black in people's pockets. "One night," said Mr. Mompesson in a letter to Mr. Glanville, "there were seven or eight of these devils in the shape of men who, as soon as a gun was fired, would shuffle away into an arbor," a circumstance which might have convinced Mr. Mompesson of the mortal nature of his persecutors, if he had not been of the number of those worse than blind who shut their eyes and refused to see. In the meantime, the drummer, the supposed cause of all the mischief, passed his time in Gloucester Jail, whither he had been committed as a rogue and a vagabond. Being visited one day by some person from the neighborhood of Tedworth, he asked what was the news in Wiltshire, and whether people did not talk a great deal about a drumming in a gentleman's house there. The visitor replied that he had heard of nothing else, upon which the drummer observed, "I have done it, I have thus plagued him, and he shall never be quiet until he hath made me satisfaction for taking away my drum." No doubt the fellow, who seems to have been a gypsy, spoke the truth, and that the gang of which he was a member knew more about the noises at Mr. Mompesson's house than anybody else. Upon these words, however, he was brought to trial at Salisbury for witchcraft, and being found guilty was sentenced to transportation, a sentence which, for its leniency, excited no little wonder in that age, when such an accusation, whether proved or not, generally ensured the stake or the gibbet. Glanville says that the noises ceased immediately the drummer was sent beyond the seas, but that somehow or other he managed to return from transportation, by raising storms and affrighting the seamen, it was said, when the disturbances were forthwith renewed and continued at intervals for several years. Certainly, if the confederates of this roving gypsy were so pertinacious in tormenting poor weak Mr. Mompesson, their pertinacity is a most extraordinary instance of what revenge is capable of. It was believed by many at the time that Mr. Mompesson himself was privy to the whole matter, and permitted and encouraged these tricks in his house for the sake of notoriety. but it seems more probable that the gypsies were the real delinquents, and that Mr. Mompesson was as much alarmed and bewildered as his credulous neighbors, whose excited imaginations conjured up no small portion of these stories, which rolled, and as they rolled, grew larger visibly. Many instances of a similar kind during the 17th century might be gleaned from Glanville and other writers of that period, but they do not differ sufficiently from these to justify a detail of them. The most famous of all haunted houses acquired its notoriety much nearer our own time, and the circumstances connected with it are so curious, and afford so fair a specimen of the easy credulity even of well-informed and sensible people, as to merit a little notice in this chapter. The Cock Lane Ghost, as it was called, kept London in commotion for a considerable time, and was the theme of conversation among the learned and the illiterate, and in every circle, from that of the prince to that of the peasant. At the commencement of the year 1760, there resided in Cock Lane, near West Smithfield, in the house of one Parsons, the parish clerk of St. Sepulchre's, a stockbroker named Kent. The wife of this gentleman had died in childbed during the previous year, and his sister-in-law, Miss Fanny, had arrived from Norfolk to keep his house for him. They soon conceived a mutual affection, and each of them made a will in the other's favor. They lived some months in the house of Parsons, who, being a needy man, borrowed some money of his lodger. Some difference arose betwixt them, and Mr. Kent left the house and instituted legal proceedings against the parish clerk for the recovery of his money. While this matter was yet pending, Miss Fanny was suddenly taken ill of the smallpox, and notwithstanding every care and attention, she died in a few days and was buried in a vault under Clerkenwell Church. Parsons now began to hint that the poor lady had come unfairly by her death, and that Mr. Kent was accessory to it from his too great eagerness to enter into possession of the property she had bequeathed him. Nothing further was said for nearly 2 years, but it would appear that Parsons was of so revengeful a character that he had never forgotten or forgiven his differences with Mr. Kent, and the indignity of having been sued for the borrowed money. The strong passions of pride and avarice were silently at work during all that interval, hatching schemes of revenge, but dismissing them one after the other as impracticable, until, at last, a notable one suggested itself. About the beginning of the year 1762, the alarm was spread over all the neighborhood of Cock Lane that the house of Parsons was haunted by the ghost of poor Fanny, and that the daughter of Parsons, a girl about 12 years of age, had several times seen and conversed with the spirit, who had, moreover, informed her that she had not died of the smallpox, as was currently reported, but of poison administered by Mr. Kent. Parsons, who originated, took good care to countenance these reports, and in answer to numerous inquiries, said his house was every night, and had been for 2 years, in fact, ever since the death of Fanny, troubled by a loud knocking at the doors and in the walls. Having thus prepared the ignorant and credulous neighbors to believe or exaggerate for themselves what he had told them, he sent for a gentleman of a higher class in life to come and witness these extraordinary occurrences. The gentleman came accordingly and found the daughter of Parsons, to whom the spirit alone appeared, and whom alone it answered, in bed, trembling violently, having just seen the ghost and been again informed that she had died from poison. A loud knocking was also heard from every part of the chamber, which so mystified the not very clear understanding of the visitor that he departed, afraid to doubt and ashamed to believe, but with a promise to bring the clergyman of the parish and several other gentlemen on the following day to report upon the mystery. On the following night he returned, bringing with him 3 clergymen and about 20 other persons, including 2 negroes, when, upon a consultation with Parsons, they resolved to sit up the whole night and await the ghost's arrival. It was then explained by Parsons that although the ghost would never render itself visible to anybody but his daughter, it had no objection to answer the questions that might be put to it by any person present, and that it expressed an affirmation by 1 knock, a negative by 2, and its displeasure by a kind of scratching. The child was then put into bed along with her sister, and the clergyman examined the bed and bedclothes to satisfy themselves that no trick was played by knocking upon any substance concealed among the clothes. As on the previous night, the bed was observed to shake violently. After some hours, during which they all waited with exemplary patience, the mysterious knocking was heard in the wall, and the child declared that she saw the ghost of poor Fanny. The following questions were then gravely put by the clergyman, through the medium of one Mary Fraser, the servant of Parsons, and to whom it was said the deceased lady had been much attached. The answers were in the usual fashion, by a knock or knocks. "Did you make this disturbance on account of the ill usage you received from Mr. Kent?" "Yes." "Were you brought to an untimely end by poison?" "Yes." "How was the poison administered, in beer or pearl?"
"In pearl."
"How long was that before your death?"
"About 3 hours."
"Can your former servant, Carrots, give any information about the poison?"
"Yes."
"Are you Kent's wife's sister?"
"Yes."
"Were you married to Kent after your sister's death?"
"No."
"Was anybody else besides Kent concerned in your murder?"
"No."
"Can you, if you like, appear visibly to anyone?"
"Yes."
"Will you do so?"
"Yes."
"Can you go out of this house?"
"Yes."
"Is it your intention to follow this child about everywhere?"
"Yes."
"Are you pleased in being asked these questions?"
"Yes."
"Does it ease your troubled soul?"
"Yes."
Here there was heard a mysterious noise which some wiseacre present compared to the fluttering of wings. "How long before your death did you tell your servant, Carrots, that you were poisoned? An hour?"
"Yes."
Carrots, who was present, was appealed to, but she stated positively that such was not the fact, as the deceased was quite speechless an hour before her death. This shook the faith of some of the spectators, but the examination was allowed to continue. "How long did Carrots live with you?"
3 or 4 days."
Carrots was again appealed to and said that this was true. "If Mr. Kent is arrested for this murder, will he confess?"
"Yes."
"Would your soul be at rest if he were hanged for it?"
"Yes."
"Will he be hanged for it?"
"Yes."
"How long a time first?"
3 years."
"How many clergymen are there in this room?"
3.
"How many negroes?"
2.
"Is this watch," held up by one of the clergymen, "white?"
"No."
"Is it yellow?"
"No."
"Is it blue?"
"No."
"Is it black?"
"Yes."
The watch was in a black shagreen case. "At what time this morning will you take your departure?" The answer to this question was 4 knocks, very distinctly heard by every person present. And accordingly, at 4 o'clock precisely, the ghost took its departure to the Wheatsheaf public house close by, where it frightened mine host and his lady almost out of their wits by knocking in the ceiling right above their bed. The rumor of these occurrences very soon spread over London, and every day Cock Lane was rendered impassable by the crowds of people who assembled around the house of the parish clerk in expectation of either seeing the ghost or of hearing the mysterious knocks. It was at last found necessary, so clamorous were they for admission within the haunted precincts, to admit those only who would pay a certain fee, an arrangement which was very convenient to the needy and money-loving Mr. Parsons. Indeed, things had taken a turn greatly to his satisfaction. He not only had his revenge, but he made a profit out of it. The ghost, in consequence, played its antics every night, to the great amusement of many hundreds of people, and the great perplexity of a still greater number. Unhappily, however, for the parish clerk, the ghost was induced to make some promises which were the means of utterly destroying its reputation. It promised, in answer to the questions of the Reverend Mr. Aldrich of Clerkenwell, that it would not only follow the little Miss Parsons wherever she went, but would also attend him or any other gentleman into the vault under St. John's Church, where the body of the murdered woman was deposited, and would there give notice of its presence by a distinct knock upon the coffin. As a preliminary, the girl was conveyed to the house of Mr. Aldrich, near the church, where a large party of ladies and gentlemen, eminent for their acquirements, their rank, or their wealth, had assembled. About 10 o'clock on the night of the 1st of February, the girl, having been brought from Cock Lane in a coach, was put to bed by several ladies in the house of Mr. Aldrich. A strict examination having been previously made that nothing was hidden in the bedclothes. While the gentlemen in the adjoining chamber were deliberating whether they should proceed in a body to the vault, they were summoned into the bedroom by the ladies, who affirmed in great alarm that the ghost was come, and that they heard the knocks and scratches. The gentlemen entered accordingly with a determination to suffer no deception. The little girl, on being asked whether she saw the ghost, replied, "No, but she felt it on her back like a mouse." She was then required to put her hands out of bed, and they being held by some of the ladies, the spirit was summoned in the usual manner to answer if it were in the room. The question was several times put with great solemnity, but the customary knock was not heard in reply in the walls, neither was there any scratching. The ghost was then asked to render itself visible, but it did not choose to grant the request. It was next solicited to give some token of its presence by a sound of any sort, or by touching the hand or cheek of any lady or gentleman in the room. But even with this request, the ghost would not comply. There was now a considerable pause, and one of the clergymen went downstairs to interrogate the father of the girl, who was waiting the result of the experiment. He positively denied that there was any deception, and even went so far as to say that he himself, upon one occasion, had seen and conversed with the awful ghost. This having been communicated to the company, it was unanimously resolved to give the ghost another trial, and the clergyman called out in a loud voice to the supposed spirit that the gentleman to whom it had promised to appear in the vault was about to repair to that place, where he claimed the fulfillment of its promise. At 1 hour after midnight they all proceeded to the church, and the gentleman in question, with another, entered the vault alone and took up their position alongside of the coffin of poor Fanny. The ghost was then summoned to appear, but it appeared not. It was summoned to knock, but it knocked not. It was summoned to scratch, but it scratched not. And the two retired from the vault with a firm belief that the whole business was a deception practiced by Parsons and his daughter. There were others, however, who did not wish to jump so hastily to a conclusion, and who suggested that they were perhaps trifling with this awful and supernatural being, which, being offended with them for their presumption, would not condescend to answer them. Again, after serious consultation, it was agreed on all hands that if the ghost answered anybody at all, it would answer Mr. Kent, the supposed murderer, and he was accordingly requested to go down into the vault. He went with several others and summoned the ghost to answer whether he had indeed poisoned her. There being no answer, the question was put by Mr. Aldrich, who conjured it, if it were indeed a spirit, to end their doubts, make a sign of its presence, and point out the guilty person. There being still no answer, for the space of half an hour, during which time all these boobies waited with the most praiseworthy perseverance, they returned to the house of Mr. Aldrich and ordered the girl to get up and dress herself. She was strictly examined, but persisted in her statement that she used no deception and that the ghost had really appeared to her. So many persons had, by their openly expressed belief of the reality of the visitation, identified themselves with it, that Parsons and his family were far from being the only persons interested in the continuance of the delusion. The result of the experiment convinced most people, but these were not to be convinced by any evidence, however positive, and they therefore spread abroad the rumor that the ghost had not appeared in the vault because Mr. Kent had taken care beforehand to have the coffin removed. That gentleman, whose position was a very painful one, immediately procured competent witnesses in whose presence the vault was entered and the coffin of poor Fanny opened. Their depositions were then published, and Mr. Kent indicted Mr. Parsons and his wife, his daughter, Mary Fraser the servant, the Reverend Mr. Moore and a tradesman, two of the most prominent patrons of the deception, for a conspiracy. The trial came on in the Court of King's Bench on the 10th of July before Lord Chief Justice Mansfield, when, after an investigation which lasted 12 hours, the whole of the conspirators were found guilty. The Reverend Mr. Moore and his friend were severely reprimanded in open court and recommended to make some pecuniary compensation to the prosecutor for the aspersions they had been instrumental in throwing upon his character. Parsons was sentenced to stand 3 times in the pillory and to be imprisoned for 2 years, his wife to 1 year, and his servant to 6 months' imprisonment in the Bridewell. A printer who had been employed by them to publish an account of the proceedings for their profit was also fined £50 and discharged. The precise manner in which the deception was carried on has never been explained. The knocking in the wall appears to have been the work of Parsons's wife, while the scratching part of the business was left to the little girl. That any contrivance so clumsy could have deceived anybody cannot fail to excite our wonder, but thus it always is. If 2 or 3 persons can only be found to take the lead in any absurdity, however great, there are sure to be plenty of imitators. Like sheep in a field, if one clears the stile, the rest will follow. Note by J.W. Archer. The woman whose ghost was said to manifest itself in Cock Lane was buried in the crypt or cloister of St. John Clerkenwell. The vault is composed of 2 aisles, that on the south being much narrower than the other. It was here she was deposited. About 7 years since, I was sketching a picturesque trefoil-headed door leading into this part of the vault, and the place being at that time in great confusion with coffins, remains of bodies, some of which were dried like mummies, etc., I could find no better seat than one of the coffins. The sexton's boy, who held my light, informed me this was the coffin of Scratching Fanny, which recalled the Cock Lane story to my mind. I got off the lid of the coffin and saw the face of a handsome woman with an aquiline nose, this feature remaining perfect, an uncommon case, for the cartilage mostly gives way. The remains had become adipocere and were perfectly preserved. She was said to have been poisoned by deleterious punch, but this was legally disproved, and, if I remember rightly, she was otherwise declared to have died of smallpox. Of this disease there was not the least sign, but as some mineral poisons tend to render bodies adipocere, here was some evidence in support of the former allegation. I made particular inquiries at the time of Mr. Bird, churchwarden, a respectable and judicious man, and he gave me good assurance that this coffin had always been looked upon as the one containing the Cock Lane woman. Since that time, the vault has been set in order, and the above-mentioned coffin, with others, put away. The niche near the window in the drawing of the ghost room is the place where the bedhead was, and where the scratching, knocks, etc. were heard. This is the tradition of the house. Mrs. King, who holds the premises, informs me that her family has had the house about 80 years. About 10 years afterwards, London was again alarmed by the story of a haunted house. Stockwell, near Vauxhall, the scene of the antics of this new ghost, became almost as celebrated in the annals of superstition as Cock Lane. Mrs. Golding, an elderly lady who resided alone with her servant, Anne Robinson, was sorely surprised on the evening of Twelfth Day, 1772, to observe a most extraordinary commotion among her crockery. Cups and saucers rattled down the chimney. Pots and pans were whirled downstairs or through the windows, and hams, cheeses, and loaves of bread disported themselves upon the floor as if the devil were in them. This, at least, was the conclusion that Mrs. Golding came to, and being greatly alarmed, she invited some of her neighbors to stay with her and protect her from the evil one. Their presence, however, did not put a stop to the insurrection of china, and every room in the house was in a short time strewed with the fragments. The chairs and tables joined at last in the tumult, and things looked altogether so serious and inexplicable that the neighbors, dreading that the house itself would next be seized with a fit of motion and tumble about their ears, left poor Mrs. Golding to bear the brunt of it by herself. The ghost in this case was solemnly remonstrated with, and urged to take its departure, but the demolition continuing as great as before, Mrs. Golding finally made up her mind to quit the house altogether. She took refuge with Anne Robinson in the house of a neighbor, but his glass and crockery being immediately subjected to the same persecution, he was reluctantly compelled to give her notice to quit. The old lady, thus forced back to her own house, endured the disturbance for some days longer, when, suspecting that Anne Robinson was the cause of all the mischief, she dismissed her from her service. The extraordinary appearances immediately ceased, and were never afterwards renewed, a fact which is of itself sufficient to point out the real disturber. A long time afterwards, Anne Robinson confessed the whole matter to the Reverend Mr. Brayfield. This gentleman confided the story to Mr. Hone, who has published an explanation of the mystery. Anne, it appears, was anxious to have a clear house, to carry on an intrigue with her lover, and resorted to this trick to effect her purpose. She placed the china on the shelves in such a manner that it fell on the slightest motion, and attached horsehairs to other articles, so that she could jerk them down from an adjoining room without being perceived by anyone. She was exceedingly dexterous at this sort of work, and would have proved a formidable rival to many a juggler by profession. A full explanation of the whole affair may be found in the Everyday Book. The latest instance of the popular panic occasioned by a house supposed to be haunted occurred in Scotland, in the winter of the year 1838. On the 5th of December, the inmates of the farmhouse of Baldarrick in the district of Banbury, Aberdeenshire, were alarmed by observing a great number of sticks, pebblestones, and clods of earth flying about their yard and premises. They endeavored, but in vain, to discover who was the delinquent. And the shower of stones continuing for 5 days in succession, they came at last to the conclusion that the devil and his imps were alone the cause of it. The rumor soon spread over all that part of the country, and hundreds of persons came from far and near to witness the antics of the devils of Baldarrick. After the 5th day, the shower of clods and stones ceased on the outside of the premises, and the scene shifted to the interior. Spoons, knives, plates, mustard pots, rolling pins, and flat irons appeared suddenly endued with the power of self-motion, and were whirled from room to room and rattled down the chimneys in a manner which nobody could account for. The lid of a mustard pot was put into a cupboard by the servant girl in the presence of scores of people, and in a few minutes afterwards came bouncing down the chimney, to the consternation of everybody. There was also a tremendous knocking at the doors and on the roof, and pieces of stick and pebble stones rattled against the windows and broke them. The whole neighborhood was a scene of alarm, and not only the vulgar, but persons of education, respectable farmers, within a circle of 20 miles, expressed their belief in the supernatural character of these events, and offered up devout prayers to be preserved from the machinations of the evil one. The note of fear being once sounded, the visitors, as is generally the case in all tales of wonder, strove with each other who should witness the most extraordinary occurrences. And within a week it was generally believed in the parishes of Banbury Ternan, Drumoak, Durris, Kincardine O'Neill, and all the circumjacent districts of Mearns and Aberdeenshire, that the devil had been seen in the act of hammering upon the housetop of Baldarrick. One old man asserted positively that one night, after having been to see the strange gambols of the knives and mustard pots, he met the phantom of a great black man, who wheeled round his head with a whizzing noise, making a wind about his ears that almost blew his bonnet off, and that he was haunted by him in this manner for 3 miles. It was also affirmed and believed that all horses and dogs that approached this enchanted ground were immediately affected, that a gentleman slow of faith had been cured of his incredulity by meeting the butter churn jumping in at the door as he himself was going out, that the roofs of houses had been torn off, and that several ricks in the cornyard had danced a quadrille together, to the sound of the devil's bagpipes re-echoing from the mountain tops. The women in the family of the persecuted farmer of Baldarrick also kept their tongues in perpetual motion, swelling with their strange stories the tide of popular wonder. The good wife herself and all her servants said that whenever they went to bed they were attacked with stones and other missiles, some of which came below the blankets and gently tapped their toes. One evening a shoe suddenly darted across a garret where some laborers were sitting, and one of the men who attempted to catch it swore positively that it was so hot and heavy he was unable to hold it. It was also said that the bear-beater, a sort of mortar used to bruise barley in, an object of such weight that it requires several men to move it, spontaneously left the barn and flew over the housetop, alighting at the feet of one of the servant maids and hitting her, but without hurting her in the least, or even causing her any alarm, it being a fact well known to her that all objects thus thrown about by the devil lost their specific gravity and could harm nobody, even though they fell upon a person's head. Among the persons drawn to Baldaric by these occurrences were the heritor, the minister, and all the elders of the kirk, under whose superintendence an investigation was immediately commenced. Their proceedings were not promulgated for some days, and in the meantime rumor continued to travel through all the highlands, magnifying each mysterious incident the farther it got from home. It was said that when the goodwife put her potato pot on the fire, each potato, as the water boiled, changed into a demon and grinned horribly at her as she lifted the lid. That not only chairs and tables, but carrots and turnips skipped along the floor in the merriest manner imaginable. That shoes and boots went through all the evolutions of the Highland fling without any visible wearers directing their motions. And that a piece of meat detached itself from the hook on which it hung in the pantry and placed itself before the fire, whence all the efforts of the people of the house were unable to remove it until it was thoroughly roasted, and that it then flew up the chimney with a tremendous bang. At Baldaric itself the belief was not quite so extravagant, but the farmer was so convinced that the devil and his imps were alone the cause of all the disturbance, that he traveled a distance of 40 miles to an old conjurer named Willie Foreman to induce him for a handsome fee to remove the enchantment from his property. There were, of course, some sensible and educated people who, after stripping the stories circulated of their exaggeration, attributed all the rest to one or other of two causes. First, that some gypsies or strolling mendicants hidden in the neighboring plantation were amusing themselves by working on the credulity of the country people, or secondly, that the inmates of Baldaric carried on this deception themselves for some reason or other, which was not very clear to anybody. The last opinion gained but few believers, as the farmer and his family were much respected. And so many persons had, in the most open manner, expressed their belief in the supernatural agency that they did not like to stultify themselves by confessing that they had been deceived. At last, after a fortnight's continuance of the noises, the whole trick was discovered. The two servant lasses were strictly examined and then committed to prison. It appeared that they were alone at the bottom of the whole affair, and that the extraordinary alarm and credulity of their master and mistress in the first instance, and of the neighbors and country people afterwards, made their task comparatively easy. A little common dexterity was all they had used, and being themselves unsuspected, they swelled the alarm by the wonderful stories they invented. It was they who loosened the bricks in the chimneys and placed the dishes in such a manner on the shelves that they fell on the slightest motion. In short, they played the same tricks as those used by the servant girl at Stockwell, with the same results and for the same purpose, the gratification of a love of mischief. They were no sooner secured in the county jail than the noises ceased, and most people were convinced that human agency alone had worked all the wonder. Some few of the most devoutly superstitious still held out in their first belief and refused to listen to any explanation. These tales of haunted houses, especially those of the last and present century, however they may make us blush for popular folly, are yet gratifying in their results, for they show that society has made a vast improvement. Had Parsons and his wife and the other contrivers of the Cock Lane deception lived 200 years earlier, they would not perhaps have found a greater number of dupes, but they would have been hanged as witches instead of being imprisoned as vagabonds. The ingenious Anne Robinson and the sly lasses of Baldaric would doubtless have met a similar fate. Thus it is pleasant to reflect that though there may be as much folly and credulity in the world as ever in one class of society, there is more wisdom and mercy in another than ever were known before. Lawgivers, by blotting from the statute book the absurd or sanguinary enactments of their predecessors, have made one step towards teaching the people. It is to be hoped that the day is not far distant when lawgivers will teach the people by some more direct means and prevent the recurrence of delusions like these, and many worse, which might be cited, by securing to every child born within their dominions an education in accordance with the advancing state of civilization. If ghosts and witches are not yet altogether exploded, it is the fault not so much of the ignorant people as of the law and the government that have neglected to enlighten them. Popular Follies of Great Cities. La Faridondaine, la Faridondon, vive la Faridondaine. Béranger. The popular humors of a great city are a never-failing source of amusement to the man whose sympathies are hospitable enough to embrace all his kind, and who, refined though he may be himself, will not sneer at the humble wit or grotesque peculiarities of the boozing mechanic, the squalid beggar, the vicious urchin, and all the motley group of the idle, the reckless, and the imitative that swarm in the alleys and broadways of a metropolis. He who walks through a great city to find subjects for weeping may find plenty at every corner to wring his heart, but let such a man walk on his course and enjoy his grief alone, we are not of those who would accompany him. The miseries of us poor earth dwellers gain no alleviation from the sympathy of those who merely hunt them out to be pathetic over them. The weeping philosopher too often impairs his eyesight by his woe, and becomes unable from his tears to see the remedies for the evils which he deplores. Thus it will often be found that the man of no tears is the truest philanthropist, as he is the best physician who wears a cheerful face, even in the worst of cases. So many pens have been employed to point out the miseries, and so many to condemn the crimes and vices and more serious follies of the multitude, that ours shall not increase the number, at least in this chapter. Our present task shall be less ungracious, and wandering through the busy haunts of great cities, we shall seek only for amusement, and note as we pass a few of the harmless follies and whimsies of the poor. And first of all, walk where we will, we cannot help hearing from every side a phrase repeated with delight, and received with laughter, by men with hard hands and dirty faces, by saucy butcher lads and errand boys, by loose women, by hackney coachmen, cabriolet drivers, and idle fellows who loiter at the corners of streets. Not one utters this phrase without producing a laugh from all within hearing. It seems applicable to every circumstance, and is the universal answer to every question. In short, it is the favorite slang phrase of the day, a phrase that, while its brief season of popularity lasts, throws a dash of fun and frolicsomeness over the existence of squalid poverty and ill-requited labor, and gives them reason to laugh as well as their more fortunate fellows in a higher stage of society. London is peculiarly fertile in this sort of phrases, which spring up suddenly, no one knows exactly in what spot, and pervade the whole population in a few hours, no one knows how. Many years ago the favorite phrase, for though but a monosyllable it was a phrase in itself, was quaz, Q-U-O-Z. This odd word took the fancy of the multitude in an extraordinary degree, and very soon acquired an almost boundless meaning. When vulgar wit wished to mark its incredulity and raise a laugh at the same time, there was no resource so sure as this popular piece of slang. When a man was asked a favor which he did not choose to grant, he marked his sense of the suitor's unparalleled presumption by exclaiming, "Quaz!" When a mischievous urchin wished to annoy a passenger and create mirth for his comrades, he looked him in the face and cried out, "Quaz!" and the exclamation never failed in its object. When a disputant was desirous of throwing a doubt upon the veracity of his opponent and getting summarily rid of an argument which he could not overturn, he uttered the word, "Quaz!" with a contemptuous curl of his lip and an impatient shrug of his shoulders. The universal monosyllable conveyed all his meaning, and not only told his opponent that he lied, but that he erred egregiously if he thought that anyone was such a nincompoop as to believe him. Every alehouse resounded with quaz, every street corner was noisy with it, and every wall from miles around was chalked with it. But like all other earthly things, Quaz had its season, and passed away as suddenly as it arose, never again to be the pet and the idol of the populace. A new claimant drove it from its place and held undisputed sway till, in its turn, it was hurled from its preeminence and a successor appointed in its stead. "What a shocking bad hat," was the phrase that was next in vogue. No sooner had it become universal than thousands of idle but sharp eyes were on the watch for the passenger whose hat showed any signs, however slight, of ancient service. Immediately the cry arose, and, like the war whoop of the Indians, was repeated by 100 discordant throats. He was a wise man who, finding himself under these circumstances, the observed of all observers, bore his honors meekly. He who showed symptoms of ill-feeling at the imputations cast upon his hat only brought upon himself redoubled notice. The mob soon perceive whether a man is irritable, and if of their own class, they love to make sport of him. When such a man, and with such a hat, passed in those days through a crowded neighborhood, he might think himself fortunate if his annoyances were confined to the shouts and cries of the populace. The obnoxious hat was often snatched from his head and thrown into the gutter by some practical joker, and then raised, covered with mud, upon the end of a stick, for the admiration of the spectators, who held their sides with laughter and exclaimed in the pauses of their mirth, "Oh, what a shocking bad hat! What a shocking bad hat!" Many a nervous poor man, whose purse could but ill spare the outlay, doubtless purchased a new hat before the time, in order to avoid exposure in this manner. The origin of this singular saying, which made fun for the metropolis for months, is not involved in the same obscurity as that which shrouds the origin of Quaz and some others. There had been a hotly contested election for the borough of Southwark, and one of the candidates was an eminent hatter. This gentleman, in canvassing the electors, adopted a somewhat professional mode of conciliating their goodwill and of bribing them without letting them perceive that they were bribed. Whenever he called upon or met a voter whose hat was not of the best material, or being so had seen its best days, he invariably said, "What a shocking bad hat you have got! Call at my warehouse and you shall have a new one." Upon the day of election, this circumstance was remembered, and his opponents made the most of it by inciting the crowd to keep up an incessant cry of, "What a shocking bad hat!" all the time the honorable candidate was addressing them. From Southwark, the phrase spread all over London and reigned for a time the supreme slang of the season. Hooky Walker, derived from the chorus of a popular ballad, was also high in favor at one time, and served, like its predecessor Quaz, to answer all questions. In the course of time, the latter word alone became the favorite, and was uttered with a peculiar drawl upon the first syllable, and a sharp turn upon the last. If a lively servant girl was importuned for a kiss by a fellow she did not care about, she cocked her little nose and cried, "Walker!" If a dustman asked his friend for the loan of a shilling, and his friend was either unable or unwilling to accommodate him, the probable answer he would receive was, "Walker!" If a drunken man was reeling about the streets and a boy pulled his coattails, or a man knocked his hat over his eyes to make fun of him, the joke was always accompanied by the same exclamation. This lasted for 2 or 3 months, and "Walker!" walked off the stage, never more to be revived for the entertainment of that or any future generation. The next phrase was a most preposterous one. Who invented it, how it arose, or where it was first heard are alike unknown. Nothing about it is certain, but that for months it was the slang par excellence of the Londoners, and afforded them a vast gratification. "There he goes with his eye out," or "There she goes with her eye out," as the sex of the party alluded to might be, was in the mouth of everybody who knew the town. The sober part of the community were as much puzzled by this unaccountable saying as the vulgar were delighted with it. The wise thought it very foolish, but the many thought it very funny, and the idle amused themselves by chalking it upon walls or scribbling it upon monuments. But all that's bright must fade, even in slang. The people grew tired of their hobby, and "There he goes with his eye out" was heard no more in its accustomed haunts. Another very odd phrase came into repute in a brief space afterwards, in the form of the impertinent and not universally apposite query, "Has your mother sold her mangle?" But its popularity was not of that boisterous and cordial kind which ensures a long continuance of favor. What tended to impede its progress was that it could not be well applied to the older portions of society. It consequently ran but a brief career and then sank into oblivion. Its successor enjoyed a more extended fame and laid its foundations so deep that years and changing fashions have not sufficed to eradicate it. This phrase was "flare up," and it is even now a colloquialism in common use. It took its rise in the time of the Reform riots, when Bristol was nearly half burned by the infuriated populace. The flames were said to have flared up in the devoted city. Whether there was anything peculiarly captivating in the sound or in the idea of these words is hard to say, but whatever was the reason, it tickled the mob fancy mightily and drove all other slang out of the field before it. Nothing was to be heard all over London but "flare up." It answered all questions, settled all disputes, was applied to all persons, all things, and all circumstances, and became suddenly the most comprehensive phrase in the English language. The man who had overstepped the bounds of decorum in his speech was said to have flared up. He who had paid visits too repeated to the gin shop and got damaged in consequence had flared up. To put oneself into a passion, to stroll out on a nocturnal frolic and alarm a neighborhood, or to create a disturbance in any shape was to flare up. A lover's quarrel was a flare-up, so was a boxing match between two blackguards in the streets, and the preachers of sedition and revolution recommended the English nation to flare up like the French. So great a favorite was the word that people loved to repeat it for its very sound. They delighted, apparently, in hearing their own organs articulate it. And laboring men, when none who could respond to the call were within hearing, would often startle the aristocratic echoes of the West by the well-known slang phrase of the East. Even in the dead hours of the night, the ears of those who watched late or who could not sleep were saluted with the same sound. The drunkard reeling home showed that he was still a man and a citizen by calling "flare up" in the pauses of his hiccup. Drink had deprived him of the power of arranging all other ideas. His intellect was sunk to the level of the brutes, but he clung to humanity by the one last link of the popular cry. While he could vociferate that sound, he had rights as an Englishman and would not sleep in a gutter like a dog. Onwards he went, disturbing quiet streets and comfortable people by his whoop, till exhausted nature could support him no more and he rolled powerless into the road. When in due time afterwards the policeman stumbled upon him as he lay, that guardian of the peace turned the full light of his lantern on his face and exclaimed, "Here's a poor devil who has been flaring up." Then came the stretcher on which the victim of deep potations was carried to the watch-house and pitched into a dirty cell among a score of wretches about as far gone as himself, who saluted their new comrade by a loud, long shout of "flare up." So universal was this phrase, and so enduring seemed its popularity, that a speculator, who knew not the evanescence of slang, established a weekly newspaper under its name. But he was like the man who built his house upon the sand. His foundation gave way under him, and the phrase and the newspaper were washed into the mighty sea of the things that were. The people grew at last weary of the monotony, and flare-up became vulgar even among them. Gradually it was left to little boys who did not know the world, and in process of time sank altogether into neglect. It is now heard no more as a piece of popular slang, but the words are still used to signify any sudden outburst either of fire, disturbance, or ill nature. The next phrase that enjoyed the favor of the million was less concise and seems to have been originally aimed against precocious youths who gave themselves the airs of manhood before their time. "Does your mother know you're out?" was the provoking query addressed to young men of more than reasonable swagger, who smoked cigars in the streets and wore false whiskers to look irresistible. We have seen many a conceited fellow who could not suffer a woman to pass him without staring her out of countenance, reduced at once into his natural insignificance by the mere utterance of this phrase. Apprentice lads and shopmen in their Sunday clothes held the words in abhorrence, and looked fierce when they were applied to them. Altogether, the phrase had a very salutary effect, and in a thousand instances showed young vanity that it was not half so pretty and engaging as it thought itself. What rendered it so provoking was the doubt it implied as to the capability of self-guidance possessed by the individual to whom it was addressed. "Does your mother know you're out?" was a query of mock concern and solicitude, implying regret and concern that one so young and inexperienced in the ways of a